I want to start with something actually that I saw today. I saw a book review today and it got me thinking about its connection to today's shiur. This book review was posted in this online periodical called The Lear House. I don't know if you've heard of it, of Jewish thought. And it was a book review of a book that just came out talking about kind of responding to a claim that Leo Strauss made. Leo Strauss was a very important thinker. I'm enabling this. Okay. And he, in Chicago, and he started to really address something that I've seen as a teacher, students bring up again and again and again, which is struggling with understanding or explaining how we're supposed to relate to revelation nowadays. How do we handle the fact that revelation is something that's not exactly provable the way that we usually talk about proof, certainly not from a scientific perspective. And at the same time, how can we really disprove the people who say that it didn't happen? And the part that caught my eye of this review is there's a part where he sort of summary, he quoted a philosopher named Joshua Golding, who a Jewish philosopher who wrote, who outlined different typical strategies that people use to try to, in particular within the Jewish tradition, to try to talk about revelation and how we can approach revelation with any confidence. And because revelation is really a fundamental subject in the Gemara that we're going to learn today, I wanted to kind of list the strategies that were raised in that book review and point out the way in which I think it sort of sets the stage for our discussion. So here's what the reviewer wrote, referring to this Dr. Joshua Golden. Such strategies include emphasizing the oral tradition's primacy over the written Torah, advocating for faith beyond the realm of reason, seeing the intellectual beauty and internal cohesion within the Torah, accepting Jewish traditions by default in absence of compelling reason to do otherwise, making rational arguments for monotheism, appealing to personal religious experience, and making values-based or pragmatic arguments for Judaism. And sort of like, how do you back up, if the question is, how do you back up our claims about revelation? So those are different strategies that are often employed. And I was looking at this list and I was trying to think, well, how does what we're going to learn today fit in? Which of these strategies is closest to what we're going to see Levinas do as he tries to talk about the meaning and the impact and to some extent the defensibility of the Jewish understanding of revelation? And the closest one of the list, I think, to what we're going to see is talking about faith beyond the realm of reason. But I want to talk a drop more about what people usually mean by that to set the stage for what I think we'll see is a very meaningful difference in Levinas. So typically when thinkers talk about faith beyond the realm of reason as some sort of a response to questions about revelation, what they have in mind is something along the lines of science is one thing and religion is another. And these are dealing with different types of questions in different realms, and the questions that revelation answers are not questions that science can answer, and vice versa. That's a simplistic version of it. But on the whole, that's sort of the way that this type of argument plays itself out, is saying that fundamentally, faith and reason nowadays often represented by science, faith and reason might be somewhat overlapping, but on the whole, they're different realms. And therefore, even if reason isn't going to get us to where we want to with faith, it's not a problem because they're doing different things. The religionist and the scientist are engaged in different projects. So I think that Levinas is also talking about a real distinction, and we'll see, a real distinction between faith and reason. But I think the terms in which he does it are completely different. So that I'm hoping that wets your tongues a little bit to get you excited for what we're about to learn. And also, just as a quick review, I don't know if you were all here yesterday. We're not going to review everything. But I also want to share the kind of preamble. Levinas has a very long preamble to this particular Talmudic reading, and there's a preamble to the preamble. The preamble to the preamble is Levinas talking about himself as a Talmudic reader. And I thought this was like a nice opportunity to kind of get us back in the mode of some of the things that we talked about last week. I'm quoting him. I'm embarrassed that I always comment on the agadic texts of the Talmud and never venture forth into the halacha. But what can I do? The halacha demands an intellectual muscle, which is not given to everyone, and I cannot make claim to it. Right? There he is, modest, a little funny. My modest effort will consist in seeking the unity and progression of thought in the text, which, as you can already see, is made up of a series of apparently unconnected observations. This is what we saw last time. We're going to see it again this time. He's taking the sugya as a whole. He's going to isolate piece by piece the elements of this broader Talmudic discussion. But his goal is constantly going to be trying to find some kind of through line moving us across the discussion. And that is different from what we typically see in Talmudic commentaries. Often Talmudic commentaries are going to really, they're going to be isolating the piece. Sometimes they'll talk about a smaller relationship from one to the other. They're usually not stopping back for a broader philosophical sweep in their overall reading. But that's very explicitly Levinas's goal. Number two, still in the preamble to the preamble. In my commentary, quoting him, the word God will occur rarely. It expresses a notion religiously of utmost clarity, but philosophically most obscure. This notion could become clearer for philosophers on the basis of the human ethical situations the Talmudic text describes. So again, to remind you, when Levinas is reading the Talmud, it is definitely a religious enterprise. He is certainly interested in learning about God, but perhaps differently than we might think. He's not starting by talking about God or describing God, but rather last time we saw this, he himself said that this is in a sense an extension of the Rambam's idea of understanding divine attributes as more attributes of action. What Levinas is saying is it's through these texts, through the ethical situations that emerge in the Talmudic texts, that we actually get the clearest picture of God. Because again, for Levinas, ethics is played out in the field between me and the other making ethical claims on me inherently as I face the other. And God is the ultimate other. Okay. Number three, last part of the preamble to the preamble. We have no right to start from a pretentious familiarity with the psychology of God and with his behavior in order to understand these texts in which we see traces of the difficult paths which lead to the comprehension of the divine coming to light only at the crossroads of human journeyings, if one can express it thus. It is these human journeyings which call to or announce the divine. This is an extension of the last point. The last point we're focusing more on what we're not going to do. We're not going to be explicitly engaged in theosophy and in a theology that's focused on the nature of God. But he's saying more than that. He's saying it's not just that we're not psychologizing God. We're looking at a different way. We're looking in a different way at the religious import and the radiant meanings that are going to come out of the interpersonal situation. Okay, so that was just to sort of jog your memory of the kind of tone that Levinas gets into. Now, to get started, we're still not in the text. We're done with the preamble to the preamble. Let's enter the preamble. And the preamble goes straight to this really intriguing title that Levinas gave to this reading. This particular Talmudic reading, he calls the temptation of temptation. And he kind of makes fun of himself in the beginning, saying, I've created some kind of exponential title. What is the temptation of temptation, right? It sounds great, but what's the meaning? And he gets started, and it's a long but extremely important and extremely insightful introduction to this text. And I think what we're going to find is that the resonance here isn't just important for beginning to approach the question of revelation and what revelation might mean, but actually begins to diagnose a lot of aspects of the human condition. And in particular, I think this is going to jump out at you, speaks very much to the internet age. Okay, and that's, of course, Levinas was, I should have said, Levinas, this particular reading was given in 1968, so this far predates what we know of the internet, but I think you'll see the resonance very quickly. So I'm going to start by quoting his opening paragraph, really getting to the heart of things. The temptation of temptation may well describe the condition of Western man. In the first place, it describes his moral attitudes. He is for an open life, eager to try everything, to experience everything. He's in a hurry to live, impatient to feel. In this respect, we Jews try to be Westerners. Ulysses' life, despite its misfortunes, seems to us marvelous, and that of Don Juan, enviable, despite its tragic end. One must be rich and a spendthrift and multiple before being essential in one. Oh, above all, we cannot close ourselves off to any possibility. We cannot let life pass us by. We must enter history with all traps it sets for pure supreme duty, without which no feat has any value. There would be no glory in triumphing in innocence, a concept defined purely negatively as a lack, associated with naivete, childhood, marking it as a provisional state to be corrected with knowledge. But is it forbidden to seek another antithesis to the temptation of temptation? Right, what on earth is he talking about? The temptation of temptation, he's going to continue defining it, but let's stop for a minute and talk about what we've just heard. The temptation of temptation, he's saying, is the condition of Western man, okay? And it describes his attitudes. And what characterizes his attitudes? He wants everything. Western man wants to seize the day. He wants to have every experience. I read this and I think about, have you heard the phrase bucket list? It's a fascinating phrase. It's a fascinating phrase because bucket list is usually not something like, I want to make sure that my children feel loved, right? Bucket list tends to be more like, I want to hike up Mount Kilimanjaro. He wants to experience everything. He wants to feel everything. And Levinas starts to hint at a theme he's going to develop more in a little bit, that Ulysses' life, despite its misfortune, seems to us marvelous. Who are our heroes? Our heroes are often tragic figures. Our heroes are the people who are making a splash in history, who are in the pages of the newspaper, right? Our heroes are people like Ulysses from the Odyssey, the Odyssey means, right? He takes this trip away from home. He faces untold peril. He suffers. He risks his life repeatedly until he finally returns home. But that's our hero, right? Our hero is not the person our hero is not Penelope sitting at home, weaving and unweaving her tapestry night after night, waiting faithfully for her husband to return, right? She's not our hero. Ulysses is our hero. He's the one we want to be. That's the thing that gives us values. We cannot let life pass us by, he says. We cannot close ourselves off to any possibility. Now, what does he mean by calling this the temptation of temptation? And why is this the case? What is this kind of feeling, adventure, experience seeking? Now, we might have thought that this meant, oh, yeah, he's criticizing the extent to which we're all running all over the place trying to seize the day. But he's saying something much, much, much more than that. I'm getting back to quoting him. Westerners, opposed to a limited and overly well-defined existence, want to taste everything themselves and travel the universe. But there's no universe without the circle of hell. In the whole, as a totality, evil is added to good. Time out. I just want to step back a moment. This kind of jibes in my mind with a pasuk from Yeshayahu. What is it? Osea tov uvore et hara. God is the one who does good and has created that which is bad. But in our tefillah, what do we say in our prayer? We say, God is the one who does good and has created all, right? I think Levinas in the back of his mind is thinking about the Gemara that talks about the fact that in our prayer, when we're referring to evil, we talk about it even there as part of this broader whole that's in life. But Levinas here is making a point. He's saying, if someone wants to taste everything, there's no such thing as tasting everything, having every experience, and the entire time completely consistently seeking that which is good. You cannot experience or live everything and restrict yourself to the good. Right? You can't have the whole universe and just be in good. To traverse the whole, I'm quoting again, to touch the depth of being, to awaken the ambiguity coiled inside, temptation is that is temptation to make nothing irreparable. The evil which completes the whole threatens to destroy everything. But the tempted ego is still outside, it can listen to the song of the sirens, back to Ulysses, without compromising the return to its island. It can brush past evil, know it without succumbing to it, experiencing it without experiencing it, try it without living it, take risks in security. I talked about the internet, right? Before we get to the internet, which is going to jump out at you, let's talk about what he's saying. He's saying, this person with the bucket list, it's not really just a person with a bucket list. We're not talking about someone who has 8 adventures that they want to have and they're actually planning to have those adventures. We're talking about a more fundamental relationship to the world in which I want to somehow experience everything without risking anything myself. And that's inherently complex because it means that I want to experience everything, including that which is bad, without actually committing to it, without actually entering into it. Again, you want to hear the song of the sirens without compromising the return to the island. You want to brush past evil, but you're experiencing it without experiencing it. You're trying it without living it. I think very much in this context of the way that entertainment and the internet work right now. Think of all of our virtual experiences that we have, the extent to which we vicariously live in other spaces. We sleep in our rooms and we work in our offices and we go shopping down the street sometimes, but just as often we might live in the internet and not just in our minds, right? And sometimes we feel that we're having those experiences. So that's what the media are trying to create for us more often than not. Watching a movie isn't immersive enough at this stage. Even Google, you're looking at a map, you can go on the street, right? And you can see the photo of yourself going around to see all the spaces around you as if you are there, though you have never left your chair, right? You can feel that you've had a wide breadth of experiences, seeing and feeling so many things without going anywhere from let your fingers do the walking. And this, Levinas is saying, because of course, Levinas is always starting with ethics. Levinas is going to be teaching us that this is something of grave moral import. Going back to his text. Ambiguity of a situation in which pleasure is still possible, but in respect to which the ego keeps its liberty, has not yet given up its security, has kept its distance. What is tempting here is the situation in which the ego remains independent, but where this independence does not exclude it from what must consume it, whether to exalt it or destroy it. What is tempting is to be simultaneously outside everything and participating in everything. To be simultaneously outside everything and participating in everything. That is the first, I think, essential definition that Levinas provides of the temptation of temptation. To be outside everything, but experiencing everything. A regular temptation is I'm in the world and I'm tempted by something to do it. This is of a second order because I'm pulled out. I'm not actually committed to these experiences. I'm not inside them. Levinas goes on and he says this temptation of temptation is philosophy. Pretty damning coming from a philosopher. He's talking, of course, of classic, as he's thinking of it, classic European philosophy. The temptation of temptation is philosophy. This sense of being outside, of trying to experience without being inside, without committing, without sacrificing, Levinas says is in a sense fundamental to philosophy. He contrasts it to what he calls wisdom, which knows without experience. And this is a very interesting question. What does it mean to be engaged then? If philosophy is trying to know things before we enter into them, we don't buy a toy, a food processor, a book without reading 5 reviews of it, right? We want to know everything about what we're going to do, whether or not we're actually going to do it, says Levinas. We're trying to build up. That's our primary, if that's the primary thing, the temptation of knowledge, this idea of constantly wanting to know before doing, before living, before perhaps trusting, which is something we'll come back to. That, says Levinas, is the temptation of temptation. And he says that you can perceive a conception of knowledge occupying a privileged position in Western civilization behind or as a background to the values ruling our morality. That is this, that one must experience everything through one's own self, but experiencing it without having experienced it yet before engaging oneself in the world. For experiencing is already committing, choosing, living, limiting oneself. To know is to experience without experiencing before living. We want to know before we do, but we want only a knowledge tested through evidence. We don't want to undertake anything without knowing everything, and nothing can be known to us till we've seen it for ourselves. We want to live dangerously, but in security. Again, this is what he calls philosophy. Philosophy privileges knowledge, starts from the point of rationalism and reason. Levinas says we've taken this to an extreme where our reason is removing us, and this removes gives us the sensation that we're feeling everything even though we're not. I think this also touches on some of the moral ambiguity of some of the things that we do vicariously, again, back to the internet or modern entertainment. I certainly have, I can't speak for any of you, but I've certainly seen things culturally, read books or seen movies, which brought me in contact with things that were very questionable in morality. And it's a very interesting question about what it means to kind of be a voyeur, what it means to be experiencing things through a lens that's touching on things that are immoral, as though it's not touching on us or what we're doing. Back to this question of being at a remove or not committed. It's what he calls the subordination of an act to the knowledge you can have of the act. Everything comes after calculation. He's not talking about the fact that we want our acts to be meaningful. That's not Levinas's point. Of course, we want our acts to be meaningful. That's something different. He's talking about saying that we need to know first, that everything has to have a pro and con list, whether or not we're actually approaching it, and treating it all as sort of morally neutral, as because we never are actually getting our hands dirty, right? It's okay to watch all these things, read about all of these things, because we didn't actually do it. We're not really there. We're at a remove. We're just increasing our knowledge. And the question that Levinas has is, what's the alternative? And this is really where we finally are going to move into the Talmud. Levinas wants to know what the alternative is to this mode of life in which knowledge, or you could even say philosophy, or the way he puts it is, the temptation of temptation is the life of Western man becoming philosophy. What is the way out? How do we get ourselves out of this loop where knowledge is primal? I want to add that I do think here that this is a conversation, again, a little bit with Heidegger, where Heidegger has his own particular ideas about knowledge, where knowledge for Heidegger is very tied into instrumentalism. It's very tied into my using things in situ, in a situation, my technical mastery, my feeling fully at one with the world because I employ things that are at hand to me all the time. It's not, Heidegger isn't exactly at a remove. For Heidegger, when things go wrong, that's when you're at a little remove and you're thinking more about, let's say, the nature of being or philosophizing more. But still, there's a sense in which knowledge as grasping, I think, is part of what's really bothering Levinas. Knowledge as grasping is almost a sort of violent act, right? It's sort of the sense of the things around me belong to me. One of his major concepts that he introduces is something that's called Jemeinigkeit, which is that a fundamental aspect of being for Heidegger is mineness. which, I mean, if you want to oppose something to Levinas's embrace of alterity or the other, right, it's pretty strong. Doesn't mean Levinas, of course, has room for the subject, and we're going to be talking about how the I comes out of this discussion. But there's this question becomes, what else is there? How do we get out of a sense? We are knowing beings. It's a good thing that we have minds. Levinas is not opposed to rationalism, but still the question is, how do we get out of this loop that we're in that I think now, how many years is it after 1968? I guess it's 54 years later, right? Now, 54 years later, where we, to my mind, 64 years later, to my mind, no, 54 years later, no, 68. Anyway, to my mind, thank you, 54. I had a mathematician in the background correcting me. Taking ourselves out of things to a greater extreme and privileging this sense of having all the opinions in place before being engaged. Is there another alternative aside from kind of naivete, which doesn't seem like much of an alternative? Because naivete is very quickly punctured, destroyed. Naivete, as Levinas put it earlier, is, you know, it's a temporary state. It's quickly altered. And the answer, perhaps, is going to come through the account in the Talmud of Revelation. So without further ado, let's finally get to our Talmudic text. Though first, we should look at a couple of psukim from Shmot. And the key psukim here the text is going to pull off of is talking about Ma'amad Har Sinai, Vayosema Sheta'am. God takes the people out to meet God. Moshe takes people out to meet God from the camp. And they stand, or they come ready, standing over. So literally, tachtitahar sounds like it means at the foot of the mountain. The Midrash, which I brought for you, it's here in line 11. The Midrash plays with this a little bit, and it also connects this to something that comes later, which is the Jewish people saying that everything that God has told us, na'aseh v'nishma, we will do, and we will hear, or we will come to understand. And here we're in line 12. Lefi shehikdimu b'tchila asiya, because they said, the Jewish people, na'aseh, we will do, before they said, we will listen or we will hear. Amar lehem Moshe, Moshe said to them, wait a minute. Can you have deeds without understanding? I'm sorry. I misquoted the Midrash. Step back. First, the Jewish people say, we're going to do. Kol asher diber Hashem na'aseh. First, they say that we're going to do. And then Moshe Rabbeinu says, how do you talk about doing with independent of listening? And this is why they wind up saying, Naseh v'nishma. We will do and we will hear. Masha nishma, and that is milamed shekiblu alehem asiya u'shmiya kodem matan Torah. This is already before matan Torah happened. They took upon themselves that they're going to do and that they're ultimately going to understand. Okay. So we have this text of Vayitzvu b'tachtitahar, which we're about to expound upon within the Talmud. And we have this idea of taking upon ourselves acts prior to understanding, and Moshe making sure that we intend to understand and not just to act. Just acting might be analogous to what Levinas has already referred to as naivete, right? We don't want it to be just action. We don't want to just be in a level of naivete, unthinking, unheeded. Nishma, we might associate with reason. We can see clearly already from what we've learned that it's going to be very important to Levinas that it's not nishma v'naseh, but rather it's naaseh v'nishma. And now we want to see how this connects to the idea of being b'tachtitahar. V'yitzvu b'tachtitahar. Amar, we're in line 17. Amar of Dimi Barchama Barchasa. Milamed, this teaches us, Shekafa HaKadosh Baruch Hu Alehem Et Ahar Kegigit. HaKadosh, this teaches us that God actually put over them, turned over upon them the mountain like a barrel. It's like he flipped it on their head and he threatened them with the mountain upon them. How does this come from the words? Bitachti, The simple reading of B'tachtit is at the foot of the mountain, but you could, in theory, read B'tachtit as underneath. How do you get underneath a mountain? Well, HaKadosh Baruch Hu can make anything happen, right? You can get underneath a mountain because he can hold that mountain under you, inverted, over you, inverted. So this description is actually a very frightening description. It's a very threatening description. Levinas likens it to, I don't know if you're familiar with the story, the sword of Damocles, right? Damocles is like a courtier whose king, that he switches places with the king, and the king, to give him a sense of what really is to be king, that's not just riches and gold, he strings a sword up by a thin thread above the king for a day's head, right? So Levinas says, and that's the sword of Damocles, because it's hanging over you, but it hasn't hit you. He says, it threatens to crush the tribes of Israel if they refuse the gift of the law. What wonderful circumstances in which to exercise one's free will, says Levinas. A sword of Damocles. The Israelites coming out of Egypt are about to receive the Torah. The negative freedom of those set free is about to transform itself into the freedom of the law, engraved into stone, into a freedom of responsibilities. Is one already responsible when one chooses responsibility? This is the problem suggested by Rav Avdimi. Does he think that the choice for responsibility is made under threat and that the Torah would not have been chosen freely? This, says Levinas, is fundamentally a question of free will. How do we receive the Torah? And what is the interplay of free will in receiving the Torah? In particular, the question that the commentators raise here is how this lines up, and we'll see later it's going to come up in the text as well, with Na'aseh V'Nishma. Why is it necessary for this act, for this threat to be taking place? Is this something that we take responsibility for being threatened? Does that put us in a responsible position? Is it something that we're actually choosing? Could we not have chosen the Torah without this having been done? Did we not show already readiness to choose the Torah? So these are all great questions. And Levinas says the teaching, which the Torah is, cannot come to the human being as a result of a choice. That which must be received in order to make freedom of choice possible cannot have been chosen unless after the fact. In the beginning was violence, but we may be dealing here with a consent other than the one given after inspection. So Levinas says, yeah, this is violence. He also defends it. He says, maybe, or more than maybe, he says, there are certain things that have to be, that precede other things. He's not jettisoning free will. He's not saying that free will does not matter. But what he's saying is perhaps, v'yitzfu b'tachtit tahar, perhaps this moment of threat is essential, because perhaps the Torah is going to make free will possible, but something has to come before free will taking action. Back to how we started, the preamble. Levinas was talking about not beginning with understanding everything, with reason, with thinking it all out. Maybe that's connected to this idea that the beginning of free will isn't couched in our terms of reason and choice. Now, I brought you on your sheets later on some selections from the Maharal, and it's worth pointing out that Maharal says something very, very, very similar. On the second page of the source sheet, on line 12, where Maharal is just talked about, he's just quoted this Gemara, he says, "Kidvarim amuchrachim liyot hem chashuvim b'ma'ala yoter." There's some things that are necessary. They're necessary conditions, and they're the most important. And nothing can be without their being there. That's why God threatened them with the mountain as a gigit, inverted over them like a barrel, because the world cannot be without the Torah first. I'm quoting this Maral, even though it's not identical to Levinas, because I want you to see that Levinas' sensitive reading of the text here is not completely without precedent. Professor Lawrence Kaplan wrote an article talking more about this, about where he sees traditional precedents to Levinas, in particular in this reading. And it's important to make note of that even though Levinas is shaping this through his philosophical perspective, the Maral was not talking about the temptation of temptation, and the Maral is not worried about the effects of knowledge the way that Levinas is. And at the same time, they're making parallel points. Levinas is saying that this happens according to Rav Avdimi, it's critical. It's critical that the Torah be given actually through this act, which precedes free will, through an act, as it were, almost of force. And at the same time, the Gemara doesn't let that go. And the response in the Gemara, is Amar of Ahav. I'm sorry, I don't even remember if I read all of Rav Avdini, so I'll read Rav Avdini again. God held the mountain above them like a barrel. If you accept the Torah, great, and if you don't, you're going to be buried right here. That's a threat. Amar of Ahav Bar Yaakov, the Gemara's response. Mikan moda araba le oraita. Says, here is a great, literally this means like a great warning to the Torah. And what it means is sort of a great caveat. So Rav Acha Bar Yaakov says, hold on a minute. This Rav Avdini seems to think this is great. This isn't so great. How can we really be held responsible for transgression if we receive the Torah through threat? How can this be? And Levinas puts it this way. If reason is to emerge from a choice made without reason, how is one to keep oneself from making unreasonable choices? And Levinas is saying there may be an important point being made here by Rav Avdimi, an essential point even, that the Torah somehow precedes the course of reason, the course of free will, and as such, it is already inherently a call to us before we even get started. And yet at the same time, there's a genuine concern that Rav Acha Bar Yaakov is voicing. And that genuine concern is, well, how do we move from this pre-reason, from this moment of threat, into the realm of reason? The next step in the Gemara response. Amar Rava, Rava says, Afal Pikin, Hadur Kibluha Bimea Chashverosh, Dichtiv, Kimu Vikiblu Hayehudim, Kimu Masha Kiblu Kvar. Rava says, even so, the Jewish people went back and they received this again, the Torah, they mean, in the days of Achashverosh. As it is written, Kimu, they fulfilled, Vikiblu, and they received. Who's they? The Yehudim. Kimu Masha Kiblu Kvar. They upheld, or they fulfilled what they had already received. So the reading here is that they had already received the Torah, as it were, by force. And in the time of Achashverosh, in the time of the Purim story, they receive it again. The simple reading seems to be from free will. Now, Levinas has some questions about this. And Levinas, I think, very rightly says, well, these events of the Megillah are really interesting. Because what happens in the Megillah is not exactly your classic case necessarily of free will, right? The Megillah is an entry into the complexities of Jewish history. The Megillah is a confrontation with the fact that, well, things are dangerous. It's not easy to be a Jew. Those who accept the law says, Levinas, go from one danger to the next. The story of Haman irritated by Mordecai attests to this danger. So what do we do? How do we understand ourselves in this moment within history in challenging the that's the way it is, says Levinas, of human history? We have this element of danger in accepting the Torah. But the moment of choice comes in the moment where we, says Levinas, in the moment where we say that there is an alternative There is a way for history not to be automatically a procession of people like Haman, and Ahasuerus. There's no way to get out of this trap of feeling that everything is fated unless we recognize somehow seizing the Torah that we can make a different level of meaning within history. Now, this again, this is one of these cases where you can wonder how much can you read into the text here, but I think that Levinas is saying is making a sharp reading. He's saying what's significant about that verse from the story of Mordechai and Esther is that the story of Mordechai and Esther brings us into history. It's not prehistory. It's very much within the realm of history. And the idea, he says, is that it's within that realm of history that we, again, are threatened with death, but in a very different way from what happened in Mount Sinai. And it's within this realm of history that we have the opportunity to make a choice to pursue something different from a life of fate. Not to just, as it were, roll as the Jewish people did in the days of Ahasuerus with the ways that Ahasuerus operated, but to seek something different. And Levinas says that's the choice involved here. It's a very open-eyed choice, aware of the dangers involved, looking to seek meaning in our progress through history. Amar Chizkiah, back to the Gemara, line 23. Amar Chizkiah. My dichtiv, mishamayim yishmata din, eretz yireya v'shakta. What is written in Tehillim? That from the heavens God made judgment be heard, the land was afraid, and then it was calm. Im yireya, lama shakta? Im shakta, lama yireya? If it was afraid, then why was it calm? And if it was calm, why was it afraid? So Levinas makes some jokes here about, can we just be literary? Can we say that you can have opposites existing at the same time? But then he points it out that actually there's something going on here in this question. And that this question is that great thoughts, he says, become clear sometimes through experiences. And we want to actually understand the precision of the situation. The assumption that Chizkiah makes is that this verse about the heavens and judgment is taking place when the Torah is given. And we want to really understand what it means for the Torah to be given. Then what we want to do is to interact with the events and the experiences as they're described. So he says, that's what's going on here. We're trying to put ourselves there. We're trying to understand to really make clear what the impact is of the Torah having been given. And the answer given is, at first with the Torah, it was afraid, and then it became calm, which is, of course, something that's parallel to what we just saw, right? The initial threat, and the later, even in the face of a different type of existential threat, the later calm recognition or choice. Okay. One more important point here. We're in line 27. Kedereish Lakish. This is like what Reish Lakish said. De Amar, Reish Lakish, where he said, what does it mean in Breshit when it says, and it was the evening and it was the morning, the sixth day? Why does it say Yom Hashishi? Hey Yitera Lamali. Why this extra hey? The other days of creation don't receive a definite article, but the sixth day does. What's that doing? Answer. Milamed sheitna HaKadosh Baruch Hu ima seb reishit v'amar lahem, im Yisrael mekablim haTorah, atem mekayimim. V'im lav, ani machzir etchem l'tov v'vod. God, he said, made a condition, Reish Lakish says in the Gemara, God made a condition at the point of reishit, and the sixth day here is not just talking about the, as it were, Friday of the week of Breshit, but it's talking about the sixth day, which is the sixth of Sivan, the day on which the Torah is given. And the condition that God made is, if you take the Torah, if you accept the Torah, you will live. And if not, all of creation will revert to Tohu Vavohu, the hurly-burly. This is, again, this similar idea that there's something that has to come before we're reasoning. There's something that has to come before our choice. That something is represented by the Torah. But the way that Levinas puts it, being has a meaning. The meaning of being, the meaning of creation is to realize the Torah. The world is here so that the ethical order has the possibility of being fulfilled. The act by which the Israelites accept the Torah is the act which gives meaning to reality. To refuse the Torah is to bring being back to nothingness. Now we can understand why that verse before made sense, because the verse before connecting the land and its feelings to receiving the Torah was showing us that the entirety of being is contingent upon receiving the Torah. We have to overcome the temptation of temptation. And the way that we do that is in this moment of receiving the Torah. That's Levinas's claim. Okay, I want to recap what we did so far. I see that time is short, but I want to first just make sure that you're with me for what we did so far, and see if we can do a little bit more with the time that we have left. So what have we seen? We saw a large preamble to this reading in which Levinas diagnoses what troubles him about a combination of philosophy, Western thought, and what he thinks Western life is becoming as shaped by philosophy and Western thought. And what troubles him is the temptation of temptation, which is the sense of wanting to seize and be and feel everything, which is often not even realized or even attempted to be realized through actual experiences, but rather that what makes it not just temptation, but the temptation of temptation is the fact that really we're all armchair quarterbacks. We're backseat drivers. We're sitting in the safety and the security of our home, of our safe places, and we are venturing out to know everything, as it were. I know everything about Venice because I read all about it and I was never there. We're waiting for everything to align with what we've seen, to the extent that we even encounter things that are unethical. We even encounter evil in this context, and we kind of brush it aside as though we are untainted by it, because we are just going through it vicariously. This allows us to live a life without commitments. And Levinas wants to understand what answer there can be to this problem of Western life and philosophy, perhaps from within the Jewish tradition. And he locates that answer in the way that the Torah is given, as described by this Gemara. Because the Talmud here is describing the Torah as being given not initially through a process of free will. The Gemara here is describing the Torah as being given initially in a motion of force, of threat. He uses the term violence. And drawing, I think, from the school of Maharal in reading this Gemara, Levinas is saying this is a sign. And we see this later in terms of how Reish Lakish describes the sixth day of creation. This is a sign that there are things that come beyond, that go beyond and come before reason. And the Torah is this thing. The Torah is a claim that's being made upon us before reason enters into the picture and before free will enters into the picture. And accepting that claim is going to be an essential first step in being able to live. Ultimately, our exercise of free will depends on the stage being set for free will. Our freedom, our liberty, depends on accepting law. That first initial acceptance of law is not an act of our thinking through our pro and con list, but it is a fundamental act of being confronted with it. And it is on this confrontation that the world is contingent. And he goes on to say, if you want to question this, he later on cites the book of Job. What happens with Job? Job, of course, is the ultimate example in the Bible of when bad things happen to good people, and oh, do bad things happen to Job? And he questions God. And one of the things that God says to him, fundamentally, God's answer has to do with the fact that, were you there when the waves were formed, when the sun was made, when the earth was created? There's some element of life, of Torah, of being, of, in Levinas's terms, this is going to be even an element of ethics that precedes everything else. And that is something that has to be accepted. Levinas goes on, I see that we're getting over time, but just to give you a sense of where he goes with this, he goes on to say that that's part of why it's so critical that we say na'aseh v'nishma, because saying na'aseh v'nishma reflects our determination to, in his terms, go beyond the temptation of temptation. And it's not naivete. We're eventually going to learn. We're going to be informed. No one can say that the Jewish people don't learn, but rather there's an act of trust. You can even call it obedience. The Talmud later calls it the mystery of the angels. And this is a mode of knowing which comes first before the types of knowledge that worry Levinas in the Western tradition. I want to, there's more to say here, and I'm sorry that we have to start bringing this to a close. I want to bring in here the way that Levinas expresses this, in particular, comes from the end of the Gemara. At the very end of the Gemara, and there are other steps, I'm sorry, we can't do together, but the very end of the Gemara, we have a mean, or in this case, it's a Sadducee. This is the second page, line 3, who sees a Sadducee sees the Amora Rava, who is deeply engaged in investigating the text. The Yafa Itzbata Dide Tutekara, and he's sitting in a certain way with his fingers under his thigh, the Kamaitz Bahu, and he's rubbing them, the Kamebain Itzbate Dama, to the point where blood is coming out of his fingers. And Levinas is very struck by the situation. First of all, he says, who's the Sadducee? The Sadducee is the person who takes issue with the particular Jewish claims to truth. And he goes on to say, you know, the Sadducee is, for his purposes, is a European. I think he said that with humor, but perhaps, as Irene pointed out at the beginning of our class, also with anger. And then he says, Rava, in rubbing, is showing us how much intellectual work, in fact, we do within this system that he's laid out. And then what's the dialogue? The Sadducee says, Ama paziza de kadmaitu fumaihu le kadmitu fumaihu lod naihu. You are a rushed, a hasty people who put first your mouths before your ears. You agree to something before you understand it. Akati bepachsu taihu kaimaitu. You're still functioning in this kind of haste. He's basically saying, Rabbi, you're ridiculous. You're bleeding. What are you rubbing? You know, Levinas calls himself. He says, perhaps I'm rubbing the text till it bleeds. Rava, what are you doing? This rush to be absorbed in your learning. What, you silly people. He's not accepting what Rava is engaged in. And he continues and he says, Bereshi ba'alachu l'mishma. Imitzitu kablitu vilo lo kablitu. First, you should have understood. And then if you were obedient, you could have received. And if not, not. You say, what is this Torah to you? It just makes you get intense and bleed. And Rava answers, Anan desagignan b'shleimuta. He says, we are the ones who walk in integrity. And he quotes a verse from Mishlei. Okay? And the verse from Mishlei, I'll just translate, is that someone who has integrity, their integrity of those who are upright guides them. It's tanchem, it will guide the yisharim. And these people who go in their kind of twisty paths, the silef bubogdim yishadim, it's the crookedness of those who are treacherous, which destroys them. Levinas wants to say that what Rava has done here is he's introduced finally the term, the idea that we've been looking for, what this means to grasp something, to take something as true before we know it and have worked it all out. And he's calling it tmimut, tmimut. And in the translation, integrity. And what is this integrity? He says this integrity is an innocence without naivete, an uprightness without stupidity, an absolute uprightness, which is also absolute self-criticism, read in the eyes of the one who is the goal of my uprightness, whose look calls me into the question. It is a movement toward the other, beyond anxiety and stronger than death. This uprightness, says Levinas, is tmimut. What he's done to summarize, and then I'll take questions. So what he's done, Levinas, and we had to skip a little bit, is he gave us the introduction to what he sees as the problem. He brought us into the text to show how he thinks the Talmud, in its dealings with the idea of tachti tahar and the idea of naseh v'nishma, starts pointing to a solution to something that can precede this temptation of philosophy and knowledge as a way of life. And he says that the continuation of the Gemara, where Rava takes pride in the Jewish people's shlemut or tmimut, is the ultimate response. He says the trust that is involved in being able to receive the Torah, at first in threat and later willingly first through action and only later through understanding, the trust that represents is not a simple naivete. It is not antithetical to knowledge. Knowledge will come. Rava is sitting there rubbing the text, rubbing his thumb as he learns the text till he bleeds. But it is a relationship to it that is upright. It accepts an idea of a good as an antecedent to what I can figure out as being good. It accepts God as holding the Torah over me the way that the mountain is held over me, in a way that calls me into question, in a way that starts off by making an ethical claim, a claim on me to start with. And that is how things begin. Things begin with a first truth, a first good, a first claim, a first moment of trust. And then there's a lifetime of responding to that through uprightness, integrity, and also study. And Levinas is fundamentally saying that that is the response to the temptation of temptation. And to circle back to how we started, so we were talking about how revelation, different strategies of dealing with and defending revelation. And one of them is to talk about faith beyond the realm of reason. And often that's saying, well, faith and reason are talking about different things. So I think this is Levinas's version of faith beyond the realm of reason is very different now, we see. It's not saying, oh, the religionists are doing this and the scientists are doing that. It's saying faith is something, is the ability to accept fundamentally Torah or revelation or good, to put ourselves in that situation before we start operating our reason, to understand that there is some absolute. And that's also why for all of Levinas's embrace of the other in its multiplicity and sensitivity to the other's claims, which might align Levinas with postmodernism, Levinas is not fundamentally postmodern. Because Levinas believes that there is a bedrock of Torah on which everything else is going to rest. Okay, I'll stop here and look at the chat. I'm sorry that I went over time. Chat. Okay. Let's see. This week's Makarot. Okay. Temptation and temptation. As Lori describes, it sounds like Abbotian embrace of antinomianism. Okay, I'd like you to explain what you're trying to say. You mean Sabbatean? I'm not familiar with the word Abbotian, but I know Sabbatean. Are you still here?
Yes, Sabbatean is correct. Yes.
Okay, so you meant to say Sabbatean embrace of antinomianism. Do Levinas affirm Sabbatean antinomianism, or perhaps the antinomianism of Isbitz Liner's transcendental? Okay, so is the temptation of temptation like Sabbatean antinomianism? I don't know that it is. I'd be curious to hear more about why you think it is. Because my instinct is to think that that the antinomianism, that part of what's bothering Levinas in terms of the temptation of temptation is very much a sense of everything needing to be governed rationally, and through, in some sense, through not perhaps the Torah law, but through some sense of nomos, of law, in proceeding forward before doing anything. So I wouldn't have thought of it as antinomian. So I'm interested to hear what your thinking is.
I'd like to send you a poem that I've written about this, actually. Do you have an email address I can send it to?
Sure. I'll put my email down, and I'd be happy to hear, and then I can maybe understand a little bit more about what you're getting at. Sounds very interesting. It's not a connection I'm easily making, but I'm eager to hear more. Okay, next comment. It sounds like Levinas is critical of the elitism of philosophy to criticize people's or society's decisions without being an activist. Absolutely. I think that comes out loud and clear. The only problem is, I think what he's saying is that has become pervasive. That it's not just the philosopher's game anymore. It's the game of all of Western man. And that, I think, is what worries him more than anything else. So one thing, if it's just the elitist philosophers, what do you do when everyone has become an elitist philosopher? I don't believe man had free choice until after the Enlightenment, when the choice was not Judaism or paganism, Christianity, Islam, but also nothing, secularism, and still be accepted in society. So it's an interesting question. Is what do we mean by free choice? And on what level are we talking about free choice? To what extent does free will depend on one's circumstances and the ability to change one's life circumstances? And to what extent are we talking about a fundamental understanding of what the human soul is? Let's say Rambam, to just give an example, when Rambam's talking about free will, he's talking about our ability to choose our own actions within whatever framework that we're in. And Rambam thinks of it as in very absolute terms, okay? And Hilchot Teshuvah, he'll be saying things along the lines of anyone could become a Moshe Rabbeinu if they so much as will it, meaning it's sort of radical idea that independent of someone's life conditions, we are the masters of who we become as individuals. I think what you're talking about in terms of free will is more sort of a freedom of choice. You use the term freedom of choice, which is really you could put yourself in a different framework. And I think that actually speaks very interestingly, perhaps this is when you put it out, to Levinas's comments about Purim and Ki Muk B'Ki Blu, coming out specifically in Purim in the context of this sort of historical consciousness. Because the Purim story actually in its own way is its own little drama of that free choice, right? The Purim story, I think the way Levinas is reading it, is that the Jews of the era were given the choice of being subsumed into the Persian Empire. And at least according to a lot of Midrashic Talmudic readings, they went for it. Many of the Jews in Shushan were drinking along with the Hashverosh in the palace. And for this, this is part of how the story comes about, and they're being punished. So that there are the different, I think what Levinas would say is that there are actually different points within history where there's also this choice of circumstances, and that's not something that's only after enlightenment, but it could be that he's sort of back reading his understanding of enlightenment into the Esther story. But fundamentally, if that idea of the Esther story is, this is a moment where you get to make choice. This is a moment where you can be ki amu v'ki blu upon yourself without the mountain over your head. Then that's something that our sages are in effect are saying there is a free choice moment being offered in the Purim story. Okay. Thank you very much, Irina. I appreciate it. How does one decide which of multiple pre-choice claims to allow to have a claim on them? That is really, I think, they used to call it the $64,000 question. I don't know if people think $64,000 is worth much anymore. That's the great question, right? So the useful thing when you're Jewish is that it doesn't feel like it's such a decision, right? If you believe in Revelation, you believe in Torah. So that's the ultimate pre-choice claim. But I think what Levinas would say as part of his project for the Talmud, you know, the Talmud talking Greek or making this universal, and he says this, I think he talks about this in other places. The truth of the matter is that this particular Talmudic reading parallels a philosophical essay that he wrote called Substitution, which forms the major kernel of his second major philosophical work, Otherwise Than Being. And that's not written in specifically Jewish terms. The question of what choice or claims, he ultimately, I think in a few places he talks about in some ways seeing himself as reviving Platonism, where Plato had the idea of, you know, of this, of his forms, and Plato had the idea of the sort of ultimate good. So I think what he would, I think what Levinas would ultimately say is that the ethical claim, the ultimate claim that there is good and there is ethical responsibility to the other, is the fundamental claim that comes about or that has to be accepted pre-choice. And then the Jew is going to express that or understand that as revelation and Torah. The non-Jew could understand it in just these broader ethical terms. I think that's how he would respond. But for him, I think that's the kernel of everything. He also goes on to talk about what substitution means for him is a sense in which we really become who we are. We become subjects or individuals. For Levinas, that doesn't start, that it's not that we are fully our own people and then we have this interaction. He's saying that this interaction, this reception of the Torah being given to us, that's even a precursor to us really being formed as individuals, that we're formed in individuals as part of this relationship to the claim that the other is making on us. Okay, I think we're going to stop now. Next week, not that Kingdom of Kibbu happened after prophecy became extinct. I'm not sure I fully understand. Would you like to share what you mean by that?
I'm saying that God is not present in the Megillah, and he's been present up to that time. He's even present for Yechezkel. He was present in Babylon, but he wasn't present in Shushan. The Akimu, the Kiblu, occurs when there is no longer the ability to understand.
Okay, great. So one of the ways to kind of to translate that a little bit into the terms of our Gemara, one of the ways to read this Gemara is to say, when you don't have open miracles, as is the case in the Purim story, that's the moment where you can actually be making a choice. You can think of the miracle, in a sense, as a less violent type of way of forcing one's hand in the direction of belief. What option does one have but to believe when there is a blatant miracle occurring? At the point at which we don't have that same sense of revealed miracles, as in the Purim story, that could be identified with, very much, I think you're on target, that could be identified with the point at which choice becomes real.
The timing, it's the very timing of Kimu the Kiblu.
It's as this transition is
prophecy
occurring.
That makes it significant.
Okay, yes.
And affirms Levinas's argument.
Thank you. Okay, so we're gonna call it close this time. I also want to just let you know, next week I had originally said we were gonna do the piece on desacralization. I'm toying very strongly with doing a piece called As Old as the World instead, because I think it's gonna do a better job of capping off the readings we've done so far. So just be forewarned, we might do that piece instead. Bezrat Hashem. Bezrat Hashem, it will be rich and interesting, and I hope you'll join us again. Thank you so much, and thanks to our emotion. Take care.